welcome everybody to this week's reading of the Independent Indie Week. That's John Federson from the North Carolina Reading Service, reading this to our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And the issue today is dated March the 6th of 2025. Well, let's start our issue today with a short article, a sort of a think piece from Durham, and it's about participatory budgeting. That's back for its fourth cycle in Durham, allowing residents the opportunity to allot $2.5 million in city funding on almost whatever project idea they can dream up. Carmen Ortiz, the budget engagement manager with the city, has worked on a PB since the first cycle. It's not just about giving residents these projects, but also about educating them, empowering them, and training them on how to be engaged in the city and learn how to move through the process, she says. One of her proudest moments on the participatory budget team comes from working with a group of Latina moms who she says were engaging with local government for the first time through the budget process. She said there was a lot of hand-holding because they didn't speak English and I had to kind of guide them. For some residents, the PB cycle is their first foray into local government. Residents as young as 13 can vote. The projects that folks propose, like ADA-compliant park equipment, or lighting and cameras to improve resident safety, interfaced with a host of city departments, including Parks and Rec, Public Works, Transportation, and, yes, Finance. Those who do participate in the process get a detailed look at how city initiatives move from idea to implementation. Ortiz says that participants in participatory budgeting, like the group of women whom she helped shepherd through the process in year one, often take what they've learned and find other opportunities to continue engaging their community. She says it's almost like they got a foot in and they thrived and did so well. And that's what you're giving community members with PB, an opportunity to step in, learn how things work, and become a leader on your own. The participatory side of the process only has two requirements, being a Durham resident and at least 13 years old. Folks can submit projects online or join one of the information sessions held throughout the budget cycle. The PB Steering Committee does resident outreach to ensure that as many residents as possible can join in the fun, and the communities want the projects proposed for their areas. The idea collection phase is now underway, meaning residents can submit their proposed projects now. Next, over the summer, budget delegates will review these proposals for feasibility, equity, and community support. Finally, in October and November, residents will be able to vote on which projects they want to see funded. Speed and efficiency are important to voters who participate in this process. Some projects are already being considered by the city, and the process can help them jump ahead. Additionally, some projects proposed through the cycle are already being funded by the city, and they get bumped off the list, of course. Ortiz saying, one of the things that's really important for us is that projects are implemented in a timely manner. The PB team wants projects that can be implemented in 2 to 3 years. Ortiz says, why? Because we want residents to see results. If people don't see the results, they're no longer going to trust you. These projects are scored based on feasibility, impact, and equity. Quote, one of the things we're being very intentional about in this cycle is really informing people what is feasible and what is not, so that we get proposals that are more realistic. The City Council already has several budget retreats and public hearings where community members could make direct requests to their representatives. They are overloaded with requests. that are restricted by budget constraints. On the other hand, funding for participatory budgeting is already accounted for. That clears one of the biggest hurdles. Recurring requests include safety and security and parks and recreation. Ortiz says that when enough projects following a similar theme are presented through this PB process, city departments take that feedback and try to incorporate those needs into their own budget to avoid using the PB money. Alex Ramos, chair of the steering committee, has spent most of his young career working in civic engagement and sees PB as a way to inform more of his community about local government. While a student at Riverside High, Ramos worked with organizers to pack the rooms at city council and school board meetings, advocating for interpreters and support for undocumented and immigrant students. He says that experience opened his eyes to how local government affected his day-to-day life. After graduating from Duke University with an economics degree, Ramos continued his civic engagement work through NC Action, where he hosted workshops on the importance of local government. When the PB team puts out requests for residents to join the steering committee, Ramos saw it as a chance to leverage his skills in a new way. He's focused on bringing more youth voices into the budget conversation. Those who aren't old enough to vote can feel like government isn't available to them or doesn't affect their lives. Ramos says, I think a lot of you think, oh, it's down the road, it doesn't matter. Presenting ideas and voting for projects gives Durham's adolescent population in particular a taste of the electoral process. The steering committee includes positions for Durham's youth, Ramos says, so these voices are included. I've had so many moms who are like, hey, tienes que votar. You have to do this with their kids who are in high school. I don't know if this person will remember, but at some time they will say, well, I have done something that's like voting, and it's related to elections and deciding something for their local community. Now, the Participatory Budget Committee team hosted its launch event on Thursday, February 27th, from 6 to 8 at Holton Career and Resource Center, with future ideas collection events planned across the city. And that concludes this article, which was published before, obviously, that meeting. But the point is that these requests can be submitted almost at any time, online or at some sort of a meeting. So if you're interested in participatory budget in the Durham, look it up. And I will just add a footnote to this article on participatory budgeting. The one place, to provide ideas and proposals online is this website, PB Durham, letters PB and Durham, one word, .org, pbdurham.org. We'll get you at least into the process of begin submitting proposals. And see what has already been submitted, I presume. So we'll just push ahead in Durham and the public schools bus routes issues. All bus routes are being covered. Perhaps the best way to get a snapshot of the current severity of the ongoing transportation crisis is to count the number of corny jokes made by Chief Operating Officer Larry Webb at any given meeting. And he said at a meeting of February 11th, since January 23, all of our routes have been covered. This is due to extraordinary events of our full-time drivers, school employees, and transport employees who are going the extra mile, literally, to fill in as needed. Directory of Auxiliary Services, Kenneth Barnes and his team have really stepped on the gas and accelerated through this process. See what I did there? Webb said at February 6th meeting, referencing efforts to get routes covered by staff who have already have commercial driver's license. Quote, this is really where the rubber meets the road. See what I did there again? He said later in the meeting, giving kudos to school-level staff for their problem-solving. And he told joint government sessions on February 11 and 18, the wheels on the bus are going around and around. Webb isn't quite taking a victory lap, see what I did there, but his dad jokes do mark a change from the previously grim tone of the besieged district leadership. The school system's transit crisis is certainly not over, but having all routes covered is a massive improvement from the beginning of the school year when students were left waiting hours for buses that never arrived. With 135 drivers, which does not include drivers who have other primary roles in the district and only serve as substitutes, the district is still below its target minimum of 155. In response to questions from the county commissioners, Webb said that a staff of 200 drivers would allow DPS to cover current routes with drivers who are dedicated to driving only, have a pool of substitute drivers, and possibly even expand their service while eliminating the need for drivers to cover multiple routes in a day. This new era of reliable daily service comes as a result of having more drivers, but also of decreasing the total number of students transported by the district compared to the beginning of the year. Since the end of rotational coverage, though, the district has steadily added students to routes. Administrators, seemingly wanting to avoid making promises they can't keep, have not made clear exactly what service will look like in a future with more drivers. That's left parents with questions about express stops, which the board approved in December, but the administrators put on hold in January. That would have required families to transport their children to a nearby DPS school they don't attend, where the students would then catch a bus to their magnet school. It may still go into effect with some magnet schools next year, though the district has not given a substantial update on that plan since that initial rollout was paused. Parent Chad Heffel said via written public comment, I'm once again asking you for the information that families should have had weeks ago. Where will the express stops be? What times will they operate? What are the expectations of parents at pick up and drop off? If you can't answer these questions by now, you should not be using this model. Webb told Indy via the DPS spokesperson, Crystal Roberts, it is, quote, too early to predict. So express stops remain an option for consideration in 25-26. The future is also uncertain for those in, quote, family responsibility zones. That's these areas close to 21 elementary schools in which students don't receive district transportation. The January rollout of these FRZs was not entirely smooth. Nearly every conversation about FRZs has included Hope Valley Elementary, where administrators suspended the plan after parents raised concerns about ongoing construction that makes the school at the corner of roads with 3 and 4 lanes of traffic unsafe to walk to. Webb said the district has hired 15 new drivers since January 6th and still has several currently going through training. Superintendent Anthony Lewis has shouted out organizations like the DPS Foundation, which have stepped in to help with the roughly $400 it costs to even become a DPS driver. That cost includes getting a physical exam, getting the CDL, commercial driver's license, and taking other tests and certifications. Webb also repeatedly said retention is the new recruitment, meaning it doesn't matter how many new drivers they hire if it can't keep those who it already has. In December, the DAE union member and 38-year DPS veteran bus driver Ratha Daniel Ruth told the school board that without access to staff bathrooms in school, some of us, quote, are out there dancing around hoping we don't wet our clothes. Webb said that since then, bus drivers have been allowed to use the bathrooms in schools, and the administration has also moved to set up break rooms at least two high schools where drivers in between routes may have some creature comforts. He said, well, Winston Churchill probably wasn't thinking about DPS transit crisis when he said, quote, never let a crisis go to waste. Families and local electeds, though, have been trying to harness that energy to create lasting change. Councilmember Javier Caballero pointed out that by getting a DPS student to use the public bus rather than school transportation, the city was creating a future transit user. Quote, there are so many people who don't want to get on our buses just because they've never done it before. If you get them on a bus at 12 or 13, you build a user into the system. Kristen Brookshire, lead school planner, highlighted the city's ongoing Vision Zero and City Council bicycle and pedestrian paths as opportunities to, quote, revisit the way that projects near schools are prioritized and consider whether these projects should be held to a higher design standard, including wider sidewalks and increased traffic calming infrastructures. Saying, if we design for kids, we design for everybody. Jacopo Montobio, Bike Durham's education program manager, who has been hustling to provide street safety education and reflective vests to students, previously told Indy that he hopes, quote, the next time there's a crisis, perhaps the streets will be ready and the infrastructure will be in place to make it easier for the next generation of kids to be able to safely walk and bike to school. My next article is long. It is from Raleigh, chiefly, about St. Augustine's University, which is in big trouble. This is titled, The Fight That Fractured St. Augustine's University. When a five-member crew of higher education professionals arrived at St. Aug's University in October of 2023 to scrutinize its finances and operations, this small, private, historically black school was already on thin ice. Founded in the late 1860s by the Episcopal Church as a school for newly freed slaves, St. Augustine's, also called SAU, was a pillar of the East Raleigh community with a legacy of educational access and achievement. But that reputation had become imperiled over the years as enrollment trended downward, finances dwindled, and the school repeatedly ran afoul of requirements set by its creditor, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, also known as SACS, SACS. SACS had put the university on probation before, but SAU had managed to win back the accreditor's favor, a necessity for higher education institutions so that they can access critical public funding. At this 2023 meeting, two presidents of other HBCUs, two senior administrators from Christian colleges, and the vice president of SACS converged on SAU to comb through the school's financial statements and interview more than 20 employees, trustees, and consultants. The committee's report, which was not public, but which was obtained by the Assembly and Indy, said the school had dire and fundamental financial challenges and a board of trustees that lacked the ability to evaluate risks to the institution. The committee found no evidence that the board had, quote, developed a process for managing the financials of the institution or any strategies for timely audits. The board had consistently approved budgets since 2019, quote, without externally audited or verified evidence of resources or operational results, unquote. The university's auditors recommended extensive training for the board to improve its fiduciary oversight. And the committee wrote, it was not evidence that the board has a clear understanding of its role in the management process, nor does it have a clear understanding or appreciation of the severity of the current fiscal issues. 2 months later, Sachs withdrew the accreditation, citing the board's fiduciary oversight as one of six violations. SAU appealed that decision and clawed its way back to probationary status with Sachs, but it didn't last. In December of last year, as the school's enrollment dropped precipitously to just a few hundred students, Sachs revoked the accreditation again. In many ways, SAU's plight is not that different from small colleges across the country facing enrollment declines and financial pressures, challenges that are exacerbated for HBCUs due to historical funding disparities compared with other public and private counterparts. But Sachs has also focused on the board charged with overseeing the university, and more than a dozen former employees and trustees have accused that board of overreach or misconduct over the past 6 years, according to a dozen interviews, several lawsuits and internal complaints, emails and documents obtained by the Assembly and Indy. The Assembly, I will parenthetically add, is now a partner with Indy and Indy Week for a provider of stories and information like this one. Allegations against the board, particularly its two most recent chairpersons, include silencing dissenting opinions, wrongful termination, and violations of university policies and Sachs requirements. One alumni group, Save SAU, sued the school in hopes of reconstituting the board. And the state attorney general's office is also investigating the school over allegations involving the board of trustees, said a spokesperson for the attorney general. And let's see, the quote, the Save SAU lawsuit says, quote, having survived so much for so long, SAU now teeters on the edge of chaos, brought to its knees by the misfeasance, malfeasance, and utter neglect of its board of trustees, and especially its two most recent chairmen. That SAU lawsuit filed against the school in May 2024 was dismissed in November for lack of standing. The university denied all allegations of wrongdoing on behalf of Brian Boulware, the current board chair, and James Perry, the immediate past chair who continues to serve as a trustee. The university wrote in its statement, Chairman Boulware, Trustee Perry, and the board have demonstrated their commitment to addressing such baseless claims while steadfastly working closely with the university administration to execute a robust financial plan to position SAU for future success. We remain dedicated to our mission and the well-being of the university amidst all opposition. Perry didn't respond to specific requests for comment. Boulware said in an interview that the university's financial predicament long predated the action of the current board, and he said, in years of neglect from within have caused the problem. In response to Sachs' citation of the board in recent years, he said trustees have made changes, including hiring an internal auditor and taking steps to get financial reporting processes in order. SAU has been negotiating a deal to lease an undisclosed amount of its property to a Florida-based developer, which has been controversial with alumni and onlookers, but which officials say will give them more financial runway. Boulware said he would not resign now, as some alumni have demanded, saying that would have a devastating and destabilizing impact on SAU while its future remains uncertain. Once it is on a path to long-term success, he said he would consider stepping down. SAU will appeal Sachs' decision to pull its accreditation at a hearing on Thursday. This was written about a week or two ago. But even if the university retains its accreditation, its long-term survival remains an open question. A year over 6 years ago, the mood on the campus was much lighter. Everett Ward, the university president at that December 2018, said, "By God's grace, I'm here today and can report to you we have saved St. Augustine's University," to the cheers of students, alumni, and community members packed into the library. They had just come off probation with SACS after struggling for 3 years. Everett Ward joined SAU after his predecessor was fired in 2014 amid financial turmoil at the university, and pressure was on him to turn that situation around. Ward was a former executive director of the North Carolina Democratic Party and a graduate of the school. Under his leadership, annual donations nearly tripled over a four-year period, the school said. After a years-long streak of declining enrollment, headcount had also begun to tick up. Ward told this crowd, "Now that we have no issues with accreditation, the sky's the limit." But that celebration would be short-lived. While some trustees at the time saw the SACS decision as a victory for Ward, other members worried the university was not out of the woods and questioned whether he was leading the institution in the right direction. Ward announced in January of 2019 he would retire that summer, but that wasn't quick enough for some trustees. In March, the university announced that Ward's replacement, interim president Gaddis Falcon, would begin, quote, effective immediately. Perry, a retired Florida Supreme Court justice who was chair of the board in 2019, told WRAL that the school could not have two presidents. Ward did not respond to requests for comments, but four former trustees said Perry and Boulware, an alumnus and businessman, were among his critics. The pair facilitated Ward's departure, said Rudolph Morton, who was then vice chair of the board. "It definitely shifted the power of the university to Boulware and Perry," said Morton. Charles Francis, a Raleigh attorney who had served as general counsel at SAU since 1994, quit the day Falcon was announced as interim president, writing to the trustees that pushing out Ward might have violated SACS rules by broaching the firewall between the responsibilities of the board and administrators. Well, Ward's end was followed by years of turmoil for the board. By the end of Perry's first year as chair, 15 out of 21 trustees had left the board, according to the school's public tax forms. Multiple trustees told the Assembly and Indy that they were given less and less information on the university's finances, and they said decisions were frequently made without following university bylaws and procedures. Henry Debnam, a former trustee who resigned, said, "It rapidly became the most dysfunctional board I had ever served on, and I've served on quite a few." One former trustee submitted a complaint to SACS, claiming that Perry, quote, stacked the board members to his favor, including removing several trustees with ties to the Episcopal Church, which is still a financial backer of the school. Anne Hodges Koppel, an Episcopal trustee who was among those voted off, said in an interview, quote, "It was very clear I was targeted for questioning decisions that Perry and Boulware had made." Perry and Boulware did not respond to specific questions about removing trustees. Some trustees left of their own accord. They included John Larkins, who came to the board in 2019 as a, quote, alumni trustee, nominated by SAU's National Alumni Association. He resigned less than a year later and led the association in a vote of no confidence against the remaining trustees, calling for the board to be reconstituted. Larkins and Debnam later joined the alumni lawsuit in 2024 that sought to replace the board. The suit stated instead of resigning, the trustees revised their bylaws to limit the association's power to select an alumni trustee and make it harder to remove trustees, requiring a two-thirds majority rather than a simple majority. The lawsuit said by driving away board members who might ask hard questions or look underneath all the rocks, the Board of Trustees is now a corrupt echo chamber. In response to questions, the university directed reporters to a June 2024 letter from Boulware to the SAU community, in which he called this complaint defamatory and said that Larkins and Debner were, quote, disgruntled former board members making unsubstantiated claims as part of a personal political agenda. Boulware wrote the former trustees' tactics are irresponsible, unconscionable, and equivalent to a terrorist attack against SAU. The disputes stretched beyond the board as well. George Williams, a 1965 graduate, coached SAU's track and field teams to 39 NCAA Division II national titles over 4 decades, served as the athletic director for 23 years, and also coached the Olympic track and field team in 2004. He's a 3-time recipient of the Order of the Longleaf Pine Award, the highest civilian honor in North Carolina. Now, George Williams in 2019 wrote to a longtime trustee complaining about Boulware's behavior toward SAU employees without giving examples. Williams urged the board to formally censure Boulware. Quote, in my 43 years as a senior staff member, I've never seen our employees suffer the level of unnecessary harassment that Mr. Boulware has inflicted. No one should have to endure the verbal abuse, threats, and physical intimidation that he shows employees. 8 months later, Williams was out of a job. The university released a statement saying it offered to keep Williams as track coach, but replace him as athletic director, and he declined that offer. Williams filed a wrongful termination lawsuit accusing the university of not investigating his complaint about Boulware, which he included in the legal filings. He said he was told in July of 2020 to accept a 50% pay cut and step down as athletic director or be terminated, which he believed was retaliation. Falcone, who had been named interim president in 2019, joined that lawsuit saying he was ousted for refusing to participate in Williams' termination. 3 other former SAU employees also signed on, saying they were fired for raising complaints about the trustees or other issues at the school. Boulware and Perry didn't respond to questions about the leadership changes. In their responses to the 2020 lawsuit, they denied all allegations of misconduct and retaliation. Now, that lawsuit was voluntarily dismissed in April of 2021. The lawyer who represented Williams and the other plaintiffs said he couldn't comment on the case, including how it was resolved. Williams declined to comment, and the other plaintiffs didn't respond to requests for an interview. Multiple employees wrote internal complaints about Boulware's handling of construction contracts at the university, according to documents reviewed by the Assembly and Indy. The complaints concerned his relationship with the Hughes Company, a Georgia contractor that worked with Boulware on a cigar bar he opened in the Atlanta suburbs. Ronald Brown, a longtime university administrator, wrote in an internal complaint that Boulware hired an Atlanta company in 2019 to renovate dorms that Brown said had HVAC, mold, and mechanical issues. He said Boulware was continually involved in oversight of their work as a construction facilitator, but he didn't think the contractor had resolved the problems. Brown, who had joined Williams' 2020 wrongful termination lawsuit, did not respond to requests for comment. After his complaint was, though, published in HBCU Digest, an industry newsletter, SAC's vice president asked the university to prepare a report addressing the allegations, documents show. Deborah Clark-Jones, who was vice president of university advancement and external affairs at the time, was tasked with reproducing the report. By the end of her efforts, she filed her own internal complaint against the Board of Trustees, which was also later reported by HBCU Digest. Jones wrote the university had paid the Hughes Company $375,000 in 2019 to repair dorm buildings without conducting a bidding process, signing a contract, or receiving board approval for the project. Four former trustees who spoke with the assembly in Indy said they didn't recall voting on or approving work the Hughes Company performed during that period. As questions about the contractor arose, Clark Jones wrote that during a call with Boulware and Maria Lumpkin, the university's interim president at the time, Perry suggested that they, quote, amend board meeting minutes to indicate that a contract was approved. Clark Jones says they ultimately didn't submit the inaccurate minutes to Sachs, but she worried that officials could put the school's accreditation at risk. She wrote, this behavior places policies and processes secondary to how they choose to manage issues facing the institution. She added, it is clear that Boulware and Perry love the institution and have had genuine concerns about its dire state. Still, she concludes, their concerns, shared by many, do not justify committing fraudulent acts. Perry and Boulware didn't respond to specific questions about that complaint. The university denied any wrongdoing on their behalf. Lumpkin and Hughes Company representatives did not respond to requests for comment. In the letter Boulware wrote last summer, he said he brought the Hughes Company to SAU upon learning that the university had, quote, less than $40,000 in the bank, while nearly $2 million in dorm renovations were needed. Boulware wrote the Hughes Company agreed to fix the dorms, quote, at cost, and that all parties, including former board members and complainants, understood and agreed with the solution. A lawyer for St. Augustine's raised concerns in early 20 about the second project Hughes worked on, updating a community health center under a grant from the U.S. Department of Education. Quote, there appears to be a contractor performing work on a building without a contract, who did not bid for the work, who may not be licensed in North Carolina, the lawyer wrote, noting that could violate federal or state rules. Federally funded projects often must conduct a competitive bidding process. Lumpkin responded that a Triangle-based company licensed in North Carolina was the general contractor. She emailed the lawyer a copy of the contract, though she said it wasn't, quote, executed yet. Derek Sauls, then chair of the University Department of Public Health and the project manager for the renovation, questioned why the Hughes Company was involved. Quote, nobody ever explained why we needed somebody from Atlanta. The university's last four audits, which are public documents, found, quote, significant contracts were not appropriately approved prior to execution, and the university did not adhere to appropriate procurement policies and procedures, including for projects with federal funding. The university responded that it checks for conflict of interest among board members and university employees. In an interview, Boulware said, Connecting Hughes Company to SAU for the renovations was part of his role and obligation as a trustee. A board member is supposed to bring resources to the university, he said. Boulware also said he was not involved in hiring Hughes for the health center project. Boulware's personal relationship with Hughes and with another trustee who invested in his cigar bar business did not end on such a positive note. A court ordered Boulware to pay the Hughes Company $94,000 that he owed them, and fellow trustee George Brooks sued Boulware to recoup a $600,000 loan. Boulware disputes the ruling in Brooks' favor and is asking for a new trial, according to court filings. By the time Sachs reviewed the accreditation in December, alumni, former employees, and former trustees were openly criticizing university leaders. In recent years, SAU has dealt with IRX tax liens totaling $10 million, a series of lawsuits claiming it failed to make payments to numerous contractors totaling more than $1 million, and a U.S. Department of Labor investigation that ultimately awarded nearly $1 million in unpaid wages to more than 370 employees, said a department official. Recently, deferred maintenance issues on campus forced the school to move all classes online. Before SAU was put on probation, the accreditation agency initiated 4 monitoring reports into the school between 2020 and 2023. A series of recent decisions have intensified the public outcry. The university drew hefty criticism for taking out a loan last fall with a 26% interest rate. SAU rejected a lower interest loan offer with the stipulation that Boulware and Perry resign, Indy reported. Now a lend-lease deal under negotiation behind closed doors with a Florida developer leaves the future of the campus property, its most valuable asset, up in the air. For Benjamin Johnson, an alumnus and member of the group that sued last year, the question of the school's survival is deeply personal. Johnson's father taught science and coached football there for 35 years, and his mother, 3 brothers, and more than 20 cousins, nieces, and nephews attended. He described matriculating there himself as a true homecoming. Decades removed from those warm memories, he's convinced of who's to blame for the university's downward spiral. Quote, "The one constant denominator through all this has been the board." Felicia Commodore, an associate professor of education policy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who studies HBCUs and board governments, said universities facing existential challenges often have to take a critical look at their oversight bodies, saying, externally, if the board signals that instability and problematic operation and possibly fiscal concerns, it makes it hard to attract partners. This is not the time we want to be restricting resources. For the contingent that wants that board out, there are no avenues beyond public pressure and lawsuits. Although the state attorney general's office confirmed it is investigating allegations against the board, it's unclear how long that'll take or what authority the office can exercise. At this crucial junction, Boulware said it would be irresponsible for the board to step down. "I'm not a quitter. We're going to fight this through. Once we prevail, I'll be glad on my terms to yield to new leadership." University officials have argued that it is actually their critics who have caused the most harm to the institution's reputation. Boulware previously described Sachs' accreditation decisions as the result of, quote, "a premature investigation fueled by personal vendettas rather than factual evidence." Janaea Johnson, a spokesperson for Sachs, said if the agency receives information that raises questions about a school's compliance, it follows a standard procedure to determine compliance and provides multiple opportunities to demonstrate improvement, saying, "Being removed from membership is definitely a rarity, so I would hesitate to say that's vindictive or retaliatory when there are so few instances." Alumni and university leaders are both focused on keeping the faith as the university heads into its accreditation appeal hearing. The university will need to demonstrate that it can operate sustainably with sound financial resources and that it can comply with state and federal regulations. It will also need to show that its board of trustees is capable of overseeing its finances. Even if the university is successful in convincing Sachs, it could still be too little too late. Stephen Williams, a 1998 SAU graduate and the co-founder of an alumni group, Falcons Unite, said, "Circumstances have never felt more dire. alumni aren't donating like they used to because, quote, it's like giving to a black hole. Nor does campus feel like it did when he was a student. Walking around SAU today, Williams said, is like walking in a graveyard. All right, my next article, also from Raleigh. Can a Raleigh pilot program hold the key to ending homelessness in the city? Every day, each day, Raleigh taxpayers collectively spend between $38,000 and $98,000 on homelessness-related services. That's the equivalent of 2 to 5 years' worth of rent. Under a new pilot program, that amount could be slashed to just $24,000 per year to pay for one person to cover the cost of their rent and case management services while they get back on their feet. On Tuesday, Raleigh City Council learned about some of the early successes of a program called Bringing Neighbors Home, which the city launched in May. Modeled after similar programs in Dallas, Houston, New Orleans, and Oklahoma City, Bringing Neighbors Home is providing 45 households, including two families with children, apartments, and case management service from local partners. Once a team was assembled, volunteers spent the fall connecting with residents of an unsheltered encampment on Good Street on the property of Dix Park, engaging with them and enrolling them in the pilot through the end of this year. In January, the city decommissioned that camp and all 45 participants have moved into housing or have a housing plan in place through their case manager. Amelia Sutton, City of Raleigh's Housing and Neighborhoods Department Director, said this approach is making an impact in terms of participants' well-being via rapid rehousing and direct housing assistance. She told the council the approach demonstrated through the pilot would get Raleigh to what we call functional zero for unsheltered homelessness, which means that homelessness is rare, brief, and non-recurring. Instead of just displacing people, we are providing real solutions, housing first and foremost, with the right supports in place. The Dix Park encampment was chosen due to elevated health and safety concerns at the site, Sutton said, and the city is expected to open the long-awaited Gibson Play Plaza Children's Playground at that park this spring. Local partners providing case management and outreach services include Healing Transitions, Oak City Cares, the city's Acorns Unit, and Alliance Health. Sutton emphasized the program's focus on the root cause of homelessness, a fundamental lack of affordable housing is the key to its success. She said, while people attribute homelessness to mental illness, drug use, welfare, weather, and a host of other factors, the only credible link is housing market conditions. In other words, places where rents are higher and housing less abundant have higher rates of homelessness than places where rents are cheaper with more vacancies. These places inevitably end up spending more on medical treatments and ER visits, emergency shelter, mental health, and incarceration. District B, City Council Member Megan Patton, asked if it further funding for the program was being included in the upcoming budget and said she would, quote, love to see a continuation of the program baked in. Sutton said her department is still identifying resource gaps in the program. Quote, we're really in still the refining and discovering and learning stages of this project. We want to make sure that these 45 residents have what they need in order to remain stable. All righty, and for our next article, Lena Geller, a long-time writer for Indie Week, has printed this at the very end of last month. A different kind of Valentine's event. Local couples gather to talk prenups. Prenups are rarely discussed in public spaces. Growing up, I'd heard the word, and Kanye West, gold digger. If you ain't no punk, holla, we want prenup, we want prenup. But it had so little context for what it meant, I misheard the lyrics as, we want peanuts, for years. The stigma around prenuptial agreements was confronted on Tuesday night at Perfect Lovers. That's a Durham coffee shop and flex space that has hosted everything from yoga classes to spoken word performance. Landing at the tail end of Valentine's Month, the event entitled Reimagining Prenups sought to reframe the legal contracts, often seen as unromantic or even mercenary, as tools for fostering honesty and equity in relationships. Rows of chairs faced the front of the room where seven panelists sat in a row. Two social justice-oriented family attorneys, a woman navigating divorce, a married couple with a prenup, and an engaged queer couple considering one. Based on a show of hands, most of the 30 people in the audience were members of the Triangle chapter of the night's sponsor, Resource Generation, an organization where young people with wealth work together to redistribute their money and challenge systemic inequalities. While the event was free to attend, the $25 suggested donation to the Pauli Murray Center reflected the socioeconomic makeup of the group. New Legacy Lab and Cardinal Retirement Planning were co-sponsors. Hilary Paulin, who is the founder of New Legacy Lab and has been involved in resource generation since 2020, was the facilitator. She said in her opening remarks, "This is kind of experimental. It may feel really inspiring and beautiful. It may also feel a little bit uncomfortable. So we're just going to be okay with that." To break the ice, she asked attendees what comes to mind when they hear the word prenup. The room was silent for a few moments. One person said, "It means you're going to get divorced and don't love each other." "Awkward," said another. Indeed, while people felt comfortable enough to come out to the event, there was a palpable guardedness around the topic. During a casual introduction before the event began, upon learning I was a reporter, a person sitting next to me immediately stated, "Don't quote me." Fair enough. Later, during a paired exercise about finances in relationship, my conversation partner appeared slightly alarmed when I mentioned I was a reporter, though we ended up having a good chat off the record. Even one of the panelists, the one navigating a divorce, emailed me after the event to request anonymity. Before panelists delved into personal stories, the two attorneys provided a rundown on prenups in North Carolina, touching on legal frameworks and common misconceptions. Milan Pham, referencing North Carolina's default marital contract, "If you don't have a prenuptial agreement, the General Assembly has one for you. It's really shocking to people when I explain to them what that document says." He explained, under North Carolina law, everything amassed between the date of marriage and date of separation is considered joint marital property, even if it's only in one person's name. This includes retirement accounts, property, investment accounts, cars, and bank accounts, as well as debt. "Sometimes people decide not to sign the default contracting after hearing the details," Pham said, "and draw up their own contract. Others decide not to get married at all." According to Pham, prenups are most common amongst three groups: people who understand the ramifications of marriage, often divorcees; wealthy younger people with inherited wealth, "My dad said I need one," and queer people who often have a heightened awareness of legal protections since marriage equality came later. The other attorney, Barry Payne, said communication around finances between partners is critical and urged attendees to start having these conversations sooner, saying a couple might have been dating for 2 years and before getting in the attorney's office there was no disclosure of what their assets are. An anonymous panelist shared her experience with a boilerplate prenup that resulted in a messy divorce situation involving disputes over debt and assets, Both she and her soon-to-be ex-husband came from wealth, but they never discussed expectations about resource distribution or long-term financial goals, she said. She warned, if you don't talk about it and you aren't granular about it, the other person will fill in the blanks. Her advice was straightforward. Know your sphere. Know thyself. Know your assets. Know your debts. Christiana and Doug Buddy Amis, the married couple, offered insights into navigating what they described as a cross-class relationship. Buddy said, like a college degree, I was told you just have to get one. As a business owner with inherited wealth, he knew he wanted to keep certain assets separate, his race car, his house, his business. Christiana said she's from a working-class background, said she hadn't been surprised when Buddy wanted a prenup. She recalled thinking, that's what rich people do. They created an arrangement that works for them. Separate finances with a joint account they both contribute to. If they divorce, the joint account will be split down the middle with the formula for alimony based on the time they've been married. For large purchases, they've developed a system where Buddy contributes some, Christiana contributes some, and the joint account covers some. They revisit their budget annually to make sure their arrangement remains aligned with their circumstances. The engaged queer couple, Kat Melheim and Rebecca Balter, also characterized their relationship as cross-class. Balter had inherited wealth, where Melheim described her background as middle class. She said her necessity to work and save will be radically different after she marries Balter, and that while a prenup initially seemed unnecessary, if we get divorced, I don't want to be screwed, acknowledging that you don't know the divorce you. Balter said she would want to give Melham a lump sum in the event of a divorce, but isn't yet sure how to land on the amount. The couple plans to address retirement concerns specifically in this agreement, ensuring Melham won't be disadvantaged if her career trajectory changes due to their marriage. And I have to drift to a close now with this issue of Indie Week. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service has run out of time, and I'm missing several cultural diet, restaurant-related things and entertainment. Hopefully we'll have time for next week when we visit again. This issue of Independent Indie Week will be available as a podcast after the initial broadcast on Friday. So, for the ncreadingservice.org, johnfederson.me wishes you a very happy week. Bye-bye.